I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to I Could Murder a Podcast. We're back once again with a brand new case. And I'm joined by, of course I am, the meticulously mundane, the maddeningly morbid Mr. Mishaps, Ben Carter.
That's cute. That's all right. I'd definitely take that. M's. But thank you very much. Thank you for the welcome. I'm overwhelmed slightly. Great to be back with you boys.
Mark.
Classic.
Oh, you interrupted me. Sorry, Mark.
So good until then.
I interrupted you, sorry.
Yeah. I wasn't finished. I was doing a little pause for effect and you jumped right in.
Sorry about that. But yeah, no, excellent to be back. We're back with what I would consider a classic true crime tale here. It's a ghastly one. It's a grisly one. How are we doing, producer Dan?
I'm all right. I'm a bit nervous because after this episode, I'm popping down to Maidstone to have 100 needles in my head.
Ooh.
Which is part of my ongoing hair growth system, but I'm hating it. It makes me feel like Albert Fish.
Yeah, you got a bit queasy in that one, didn't you?
Didn't he have needles in his gooch or something?
Yeah. Afterwards, immediately you go and murder kids.
Yeah.
So it's
don't know what came over me. but apart from that, I'm great. Thank you, boys.
Fantastic. Well, let's hope the doctor serving you today, do they serve, is better than today's alleged doctor because, terrifying, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah, treats people, treating, but that's fine. Yeah, but as well, guys, we want to announce three new members to the ICMAP gang. We've got some bloody new merch. The sunny side up range has grown. We've got a cheeky little sundae, a hot dog, and a little waffle. We know that the joke's going to come about the waffle, but yes, it's new on the website. Obviously, you can see now on the screen. Why not head over and get involved? Yeah, we thought we'd be a little bit cheeky with some new merch.
But it's a really delightful little range, and we've all got our favourites. We're interested to see which one you guys enjoy the most. But Tom, where can I find this merch?
ICMAP.co.uk.
Fantastic stuff.
Ben, you want to nag them to do something else as well?
Another little nag, if I may, and then we'll jump straight into it because we like to jump straight into things.
You nag.
We are currently being considered for two different awards as part of the 2024 True Crime Awards, one of which is Listener's Choice for those joining us via the ears, and one of those is Viewer's Choice for those joining us via the eyes. You just go over to truecrimeawards.co.uk or com. They both kind of redirect to the same place, and it literally takes a minute of your time to vote for us. Just put ICMAP or I Could Murder a Podcast. Every vote counts in this, and we are super pumped to be in the running for a couple of little awards. So please consider voting for us. It would mean the world to your boys here at ICMAP.
Lovely stuff. Well, enough waffle. Bit of a theme there. Get the t-shirt, you'll love it. We're going to move on to today's case. Ben, this case goes by many a name. Would you care to share with the listeners and viewers what case we're going for today?
I can certainly do that for you.
I won't do that because it's too fucking random. Doing that voice.
It's like QVC.
It's really not.
So today, of course, is the case of John Reginald Christie, the monster of Rillington Place. This also goes by the Notting Hill Murders, the Rillington Strangler, 10 Rillington Place, the Horror House, and the Case of Reg, which a lot of angry people about the cryptic clue last week. Ooh, that's a weird looking number plate. I don't like it. Registration number, registration plate, Reg.
But then I don't get the I don't like it bit.
I don't like him. He's strange.
By far the worst.
By far the worst, but stay tuned because at the end of this episode, it is the one that I promised a meal with me or on behalf of me, if anyone gets it, because this is my most difficult one yet. I've outdone myself.
But probably not the worst thing you'll say throughout this episode.
Good odds on that.
But as we like to do, we go to producer Dan to set the scene for today's case.
On the seemingly ordinary streets of mid-century London, with a new queen on the throne and memories of the war fading, Mr. John Reginald Christie harboured a dark secret hidden in plain sight amidst the bustling city life. The unassuming, alleged medical professional and police constable ensnared unsuspecting victims with charm and deceit, inviting them into his home under false pretences. Behind closed doors, his facade crumbled, revealing the true horrors that lurked within. Women vanished without a trace, their fates sealed by Christie's evil desires. Each victim became another chapter in his macabre, twisted story, their remains concealed within the very walls of his residence. As the city continued on, oblivious to the atrocities unfolding within its midst, John Christie resumed his reign of terror, a shadowy figure haunting the collective consciousness of the capital with his chilling series of gruesome crimes.
Oh, sends shivers, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, it really does.
Literally did.
Yeah. But yeah, this is a case we've wanted to cover for a little while. It does pop up now and again in the case requests. This is actually one that my dad and grandma have requested since we started the podcast. So it only took 9 series for me to get round to it.
Very snidey of you.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, come on. So yeah, this is a case that they have been fascinated by. It's, as we said, kind of an old school classic true crime, but it's full of twists and turns, much like this series has been so far. But yeah, really fascinating one. So much to unpack, you know, a lot of similarities with other cases we've covered in the past, but still something different at each turn. So it's, yeah, for me, this is an interesting one, and I'm really excited to cover it today with you boys.
It's a case that has a few things in common with other cases we've covered. Definitely going through the childhood, I immediately thought of another case we've covered. But yeah, it's a very dark one. And weirdly, even though a lot of people say it's kind of one of the big names in the UK true crime, maybe my ignorance, never heard of it. Dan, have you heard of it before?
No, I'm afraid not. No.
Yeah, it's a very interesting and dark one, and yeah, I'm looking forward to getting into it and exploring the twisted mind of Reggie.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that annoyed me that he always sort of went by Reg, and just unassuming guy hidden in plain sight, and yeah, call me Reg.
What should he go
not
by?
Annoy me. That's his middle name. He can go by what he wants. But in
hi, I'm Killer. I'm Killer.
But I've been over the last few weeks, I've been watching a couple of dramatizations of this case and documentaries, and all the reenactments have just a very call me Reg, darling. Let's have a cup of tea. And I'm just
where's
like, I don't drink Yorkshire, which actually your go to is Yorkshire. So excited for that. But he's just he creeps me out. I find this case quite uncomfortable, but still very intriguing.
So as always, as well as the setting the scene, we start off with a little quote, and there will be some particularly bizarre ones this week, and this one comes from John Christie himself.
The sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, fascinated me. I always knew that someday I should defy it. My first murder was thrilling, because I had embarked on the career I'd chosen for myself, the career of murder.
So we're going to take a look into the fascinating life and the stomach-turning crimes of John Christie and explore exactly how number 10 Rillington Place became a real-life horror house.
Tom's getting emotional.
Yeah.
You're right, mate.
Just horror houses get a bad rep.
They do. They do, man. Am I loud enough?
Too loud.
Sorry, am I too loud, am I?
Okay, hey, your level's all right, aren't you?
Okay, cool. John Reginald Halliday Christie.
Oh, God, that's obnoxious.
Too loud.
Whoa. John Reginald Halliday Christie was born on the 8th of April 1899 in a former inn known as Black Boy House, which was located in the small village of Northerham, which is in Halifax, West Yorkshire. He was the 6th of 7 children born to Ernest John Christie and Mary Hannah Halliday, being the youngest male in a predominantly female household. The family of 9 initially lived in small, cramped conditions, and their financial situation was often precarious. This was mainly based on the size of the family rather than Ernest's slightly above average salary. John's father, Ernest, was a very strict man who showed very little affection or interest towards his children. The word austere has been used quite often to describe the man. Ernest was a carpet designer and weaver by trade for Dean Clough Mill, and he would spend a lot of his time away from the family home, leaving his wife Mary to look after the seven Christie children by herself. Mary, meanwhile, encountered numerous challenges with her mental health over the years, but tended to favour John over her other children, whom she viewed as difficult and different. She would affectionately refer to John as Our Reg or Reggie, but much less kind nicknames would follow for the boy.
Yeah, that's a bit where I get some similarities to another case we've covered. From as early as he was able to remember, John had a strained relationship with his father. Whenever his father was back at the family home, he would retreat into his own room where he would smoke and drink. If he wasn't doing this, he would be out and around the house looking for the slightest reason to punish his children. Physical punishment would often be Ernest's only social interaction that he was interested in, and as a result, John grew extremely distant and resentful of him.
He completely dominated all of us in every possible way. We rarely saw him, but we were all terrified of him. He didn't communicate, and everything had to go through Mother. We almost had to ask if we could speak to him.
It's difficult if you try not to speak to him, you ask him if he can speak to him. That's immediately going to piss him off.
As well as this, Ernest was a founding member of the Halifax Conservative Party and a senior member of the Primrose Society. So yeah, the Primrose Society was an organisation who promoted purity of the working classes, meaning that obviously at the time, England, there were very few jobs available, but the Primrose Society were very keen that any jobs should be given exclusively to white people. He was clearly a very, very busy man.
And racist man.
Yeah, busy and racist, which is an awful combination, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's awful. Fine being busy, but...
Yeah, but not a busy racist, Tom.
Yeah, oh yeah, I think that's... Yeah, I don't like the racist bit. Yeah.
So despite him being so busy, he also managed to find time to become the first superintendent of St. John's Ambulance Service in Halifax. This medical exposure may have influenced a young John Christie. John's mother, Mary, was actually nicknamed Beauty Halliday shortly before she met Ernest. She was considered one of the most beautiful girls in her village, and she had a keen interest in becoming an actress or working in the theatre, with everybody that knew her believing that she would make her dream a reality. But she put her dreams on hold when she met and subsequently married Ernest, with the young couple quickly going on to have seven surviving children over a 16-year period. So yeah, due to medical complications of the time, there were a number of siblings that John would have had that sadly passed away at childbirth.
Though we mentioned that John and his mother were incredibly close, it is referenced in other books and articles that she, along with his older sisters, would regularly bully and tease a young John, who was very small and skinny for his age. It is possible that he was beaten by both his mother and father, as well as his older sisters, quite possibly being dominated by all of them. From a young age, John displayed troubling behaviour, often getting into trouble at school and also showing signs of cruelty towards animals, often picking up, throwing and kicking stray cats and dogs. Whenever he was reprimanded, he would either remain completely emotionless and stare at the accuser, or begin to sulk. Despite his shy and introverted personality, there seemed to be a lot more than met the eye brewing beneath the surface of John Christie. Being told off and then immediately just staring at them like, emotionless. Yeah. Just weird.
Is he just socially awkward, or is he trying to stare them out?
I don't know. He's got a lot of gall for someone who's essentially getting all his sisters bullying him and his parents, and he's going around kicking cats.
Well, I'm not sure if this is the childhood that you had in mind, the similar case we've covered before, but when John was 8 years old, his maternal grandfather passed away after battling with a long-term illness. Much like what we saw with a five-year-old Dennis Nielsen, John was asked if he wanted to see his granddad one last time. John said yes and was walked into the family living room by his mother. He was met by the sight of his grandfather's corpse laid out across a trestle table, and he would later recall feeling very mixed and very concerning feelings towards the moment. John claimed that this day changed his life forever when he suddenly felt an overwhelming sense of power and satisfaction, knowing that a man he once feared was now just a corpse. He also claimed that he felt a trembling sensation run through all of his body, as well as pleasure and fascination at the sight of his now deceased grandfather.
Yeah, actually, but that's not actually the one I was talking about. But yeah, that's definitely makes a lot of sense because, yeah, it's he had the feeling with seeing his granddad that he could control people and they can't get him back, essentially. Now, mine is coming up very soon, I believe. Yes, there's a few cases this one interlocks with.
Yeah, definitely. Well, stay tuned for that. At school, John displayed an above-average intelligence, so much so that he won a scholarship to attend Halifax Secondary School, where he excelled at mathematics and also had a fondness for algebra and arithmetic. He was top of the class for both those subjects. Any algebra
buffs?
Any algebra boys in the house?
No, big fan of algebra.
No. Dan?
I can't stand maths. I hate it with a passion and it scares me.
I like mental maths. I like that. Don't know if you can call that anymore.
It's an interesting question.
Is mental maths...
I'd assume they've sort of outlawed that one.
The mental method, also known as mental maths, is... Oh, it doesn't seem to be.
Oh. Top of the class, he was somewhat of a boffin. Though socially, he struggled to make or maintain any friends. He was an excellent student who was also interested in history and woodwork. By the age of 12, John became an assistant scout master at his local Boy Scouts, and he also started singing in the local church choir. By the age of 14, he was believed to have had an IQ of 126. So yeah, very, very smart young John.
And in today's IQ, that's what, a million and...
yeah, inflation.
Oof. Yeah.
Big brain.
Assistant scout master.
I'd rather just be a regular scout at that
You've
point.
Written assistant to the scout master in your notes.
I did, yeah. Had a little, very Gareth, isn't he? Or Dwight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But obviously, he's worse than them.
Yeah.
A lot.
I always made certain I mastered any subject I took up. Before I was a teenager, I could build toys. Well done, mate. Administer first aid or repair watches. But once I'd mastered something, my interest in it ended.
Yeah, which, you know, is an interesting thing, isn't it? Be able to, as soon as you've conquered something, you move on. But I guess that's the modern day equivalent to playing a computer game, complete it.
Yeah. Doing a nice Sudoku.
What, currently? Or
he could be. He could quite like a, you know, a book of crosswords and Sudokus, not get too bored of them, I thought.
Again, despite performing so well academically, he continued to really struggle socially. Sorry, Ben, that's not about Ben, this is about the guy. His peers described him as a queer lad who kept himself to himself and was not very popular.
So that's about John.
Yeah, about Reggie. John's upbringing was further disrupted when his mother was allegedly institutionalised for her continued mental health issues. This instability, combined with what we are about to discuss, likely had a profound impact on his psyche, contributing to his later criminal behaviour, especially when considering female influences in his life. Despite these hardships, John managed to complete his education at the age of 14 with excellent grades. Though opportunities for academics were limited at the time, so John began working in a ticket booth and as a projectionist at Gem Cinema in Halifax. It's the first time I've ever read that word, I think, in my life.
Projectionist.
Yeah, ticket booth and projectionist. I mean, surely... Oh, hold on! I saw the tickets right. It's busy, isn't it? Back and forth. But yeah, Gem Cinema.
Yeah.
Nice. He much preferred being in the rafters as a projectionist than front of house, dealing with customers who would often tease him. He doesn't really get a break, does he?
No.
Can I have two tickets, you prick? Oh, yeah, yes. But yeah, he's getting it from all angles.
He is, yeah. Those were the days, going to the Flicks, Gem Cinema at Halifax, to see Chaplin and Monroe. It is during his mid-teen years that John began to encounter his first sexual urges. He would vividly recall one particular occasion when he was visiting his eldest sister, who had recently married. He accidentally observed her getting changed in her bedroom, but he continued to watch on as he slowly became aroused. Perhaps due to the fact that his sisters had so often dominated him, John felt power in being able to see her so vulnerable and get away with it. He spent the remainder of the visit red in the face and was unable to look his sister in the eye from this point onwards. Later that year, John overheard his colleagues at Gem Cinema talking about a lover's lane, and this particular lover's lane was known as Monkey Run, and this is where teenagers would go during the evenings to drink alcohol and to be intimate with one another. So John informed them that he would be interested in attending, and so he and a small group of friends went down Monkey Run late in the summer of 1914. There, 15-year-old John would be paired with a much older girl who was much more sexually experienced in comparison. Despite his efforts, John could not become significantly aroused and was overcome by nerves. The couple returned to the group later that night, where John was berated in front of everybody. Word quickly spread around town, and so people began referring to John as Reggie No Dick and Can't Do It Christy. There were also whispers of somebody viciously calling him Slow Dong John and even No Dong John, which is... kids can be so, so cruel. John would never forget these humiliations that he experienced, and would also continue to encounter impotence issues later in life.
I guess Limp Cock Christy, like Limp for Christy, Limp Cock. But before Limp for Christy was a...
Before it's time.
Before it's time, but...
Yeah, terrible though, isn't it? Just call me Reg.
Reggie No Dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Horrible. Benny. No.
What? I'm just thinking of words. Can't do it, Carter.
It works.
False starter, Carter. You come before you even... Okay, that's... Bra.
Very good. That's any more?
Nah.
Do me.
Limp Cock Lambert.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Sorry, Dan. I don't want to pile in on you.
Clip it.
I haven't got much more because limp is probably as far as you.
Danny Dangle,
Daniel Pedophile Lambert.
Imagine
people are going around calling your names, Dan. What is it? Oh dear. Shortly after this incident, John left his job at the cinema and started working as an admin clerk with the local police. He met everything they were looking for. He was intelligent, diligent, and incredibly well organised. Sadly, he would not last long in this role, as he was later dismissed after he was caught stealing evidence. Which is, for his, is out of character, I would have thought, for John. When news of this reached his incredibly strict father, who was now running the family home without the support of his wife, John was immediately kicked out and told to leave the village at just 17 years old. So John was now completely alone. Years went by and John travelled between different small towns and cities looking for work. He briefly held a series of different jobs, including work as a watch repairer, a shoemaker, a security guard and a store clerk. But once again, he was dismissed from these roles rather quickly. Yeah, going for the candlestick maker, cobbler. Yeah, Jesus. This ultimately resulted in John becoming somewhat of a drifter, occasionally sleeping on his father's allotment, which I'd piss him off, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would, yeah.
Who's been laying on my pumpkins? With his sisters waiting until dark to sneak food for him. Like a pet.
Yeah, very much like a pet. I mean, straight away when you describe the sort of Christy laying at night on a pumpkin patch, I have an urge to put that into an AI image generator, maybe with a woman bringing a sandwich to him.
Think about Peter Rabbit.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Nibbling on a carrot.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Overall, there was a significant amount of disruption and dysfunction in John's childhood, with a great deal of trauma and poverty that he had to endure. He wanted to completely change his life and identity, and the outbreak of World War I gave him the perfect opportunity to do so.
In 1916, as he approached his 18th birthday, John was called up for service in the British Army, and he was immediately sent to France. He served as an infantryman for the 52nd Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire Regiment for the following 2 years, where he was also seconded as a signalman following casualties in his regiment. John was very, very happy about this sort of brief promotion, as this position as a signalman made it less likely that he would have to get involved in military combat, and he would be more focused on relaying communications to other headquarters and personnel. There isn't a great deal of information available about his time with the army, but his service is noted to have been marred by a series of disciplinary issues. So it seems like any job he lands, even in the army now, he can't quite keep a clean slate. He's always doing something or pissing someone off, or is he? I don't know. It does seem quite out of character at this point.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, for a person who did very well in school, But there's always, it was always there. If he was doing things, you know, being cruel to animals, there's always something there with, deep within him. And did the family dynamic really affect the way, you know, he wasn't able to be the man of the house or stand up for himself there? So is he taken out in weird, snidey little ways as he gets older?
Yeah, underlying issues.
Mm.
In June of 1918, John and his regiment were bombarded by a series of mustard gas attacks just north of Calais. This attack left him and many other soldiers immobilized and requiring hospital treatment. John spent the rest of the month in a military hospital in Calais, where he claimed that the gas bombs had rendered him completely disabled. He claimed that he could not see or hear, and he also struggled to speak or walk. He would make bold claims later in life that this resulted in him being blind and mute for the next 3.5 years, though medical records and witness testimony tell a very different story. It is worth noting, obviously, that he would not have been discharged from this hospital just a month later, if that was the case, though it is definitely possible that from this moment onwards and from the trauma inflicted from these events, he did speak more quietly, and this is put down to a psychological effect of the gassing rather than a toxic effect. So apparently, yeah, he was just potential PTSD, and he would just be a lot more quiet from this point onwards. John was demobilized from the British Army in the winter of the following year and immediately returned to England, where he would begin to visit family and friends, and pretty much from what I gather here, anyone that would listen to him, to tell stories of his heroics during the war. He would regularly exaggerate these stories as well as feign different injuries that he would pair up to match these stories. His stories were never gruesome or vulgar, but all of them resulted in him basically saying that he saved a great number of lives, that he was a war hero, a field medic. He really exaggerated his experiences, kind of like a little bit like what we saw in the Michael Peterson staircase episode, but he really spun the yarn with this one. He would also begin to read numerous medical books and also quiz his father, who I assume that now they've sort of patched their relationship back up after his military service. He would ask his father lots of questions about first aid, so that basically the more he learned about medicine and first aid, the more he could embellish these stories that he was telling people. I think he was just looking for a lot of pints to be bought for him.
I mean, that's definitely another like key trait, isn't it? Like embellishing, making themselves feel powerful, and yeah, telling stories which no one can kind of dispute because they weren't there.
One moment he's limping, and then they see him leaving the pub and he's fine. Maybe. Arm in a sling.
Bundy.
Yeah.
So this links to Christie potentially developing HPD, which is histrionic personality disorder, which is essentially but not limited to displaying a pattern of excessive attention-seeking behaviours and having a high desire for approval or sympathy. There you go. Cut me out with a broom! Shortly after he had returned from war, John began to visit different pubs and brothels and shares his stories with local sex workers. Despite his stories of being a hardened war veteran, John continued to find it hard to stand to attention when it came to bedroom matters. The link I had to another case was Chikatilo, in terms of being unable to perform and feeling very infuriated with women because of his lack of performance.
They're visually quite similar as well. Just pop some glasses on Chikatilo. Well, he sometimes wore glasses, didn't he?
He did, yeah, famously.
Ooh. Yeah, they could be brothers.
Brothers Grimm.
Yeah.
This infuriated John, and though the childhood nicknames were long gone, he felt a horrible sense of familiarity when it came to being overcome with embarrassment and emasculation. John would receive a disability pension for the next year before he eventually took up work as a postman. Whilst delivering mail, he met Ethel Simpson, a very shy, placid and passive individual who was highly intelligent and described as very beautiful. Ethel had been through a series of neglectful relationships but found John to be charming and polite. The pair got married the following year, which is quick, in May of 1920. The pair were very rarely intimate with one another, with Ethel sadly experiencing a miscarriage not long after the wedding, so John continued to visit different brothels on the outskirts of town.
He's always doing something shady, isn't he?
Yeah, John. I mean, found a nice woman, got married, don't need to be having it away all the time.
Right.
Just a year after the pair were married, John was dismissed from his role as a postman, shock, due to being found stealing money from letters he was delivering. So yeah, you know when you get a package sometimes, you're like, this has been... it's been looked into. I had a package the other day. I was like, this looks very...
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's nothing no one else would want, so it's fine. He was sentenced to serve between 3 to 9 months in prison at HMP Manchester. Just a year after his release, he was arrested once again, this time for violent conduct and obtaining money under false pretenses, for posing as a former senior-level military officer. A lot of gall for again, like someone I don't know where he's getting the confidence from.
Yeah, and it's continuous as well. It's not like he's put off by being put in prison. I thought that first offence, the postman one, that might have set him on the straight and narrow, but if anything, it makes him worse.
Yeah, I'd say he's got a gallbladder because he's pissing everyone off. He received a slightly more lenient 12 months of probation for this, but that didn't sway his criminal behaviours. Despite Ethel standing by John throughout all of this, their marriage broke down after 4 years and she moved between Bradford and Sheffield in order to live with family and stay away from John. That's the line that really sticks, stay away from. So she herself is very uncomfortable with the idea of John in his presence.
In 1924, with Ethel no longer by his side, John was arrested for a third time, this time for 2 counts of larceny. He was sentenced to serve 9 months at HMP Wandsworth. Upon his release, John drifted all over the UK once again, picking up odd jobs where he could and begging on the streets as an unemployed war veteran. See, what we know about him so far, I would have assumed that this was beneath him, that act, but as we'll go on to see, I don't think there are many things beneath this horrible bastard. He tried to find Ethel as he drifted across different parts of Yorkshire, but he was unable to find her. In 1927, John began working as a lorry driver and relocated to Battersea in London, where he took up shared accommodation. He shared a rundown flat with a sex worker named Maud Cole. And after sharing this flat for 2 years with Maud, this came out of the blue. It's unclear as to how or why this came about, but one night, John struck Maud over the head with a cricket bat and attempted to rape her. Maud fortunately survived the incident and reported it to the police, with John being sentenced to 6 months hard labour as a result. The judge in delivering this particular sentence referred to the incident as a murderous attack.
So John's account on this is very different. He essentially said he was testing out the cricket bat, and he thought he had hit a chair. And only when he turned round, he realised he smacked Maud in the head.
Mm-hmm.
Too many people test out cricket bats inside, just swinging it around, going, yeah, it's good. I don't even know what phrase you'd even use.
Yeah, I'm not really a cricket guy, but I assume they would test a bat in nets, you know, outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were all the lights off then? Were all the lights... That's his only excuse. Yeah, it was complete... Who tests a cricket bat in pitch dark?
Mm.
John does, obviously, but...
Reggie...
Yeah, I was shocked by the sentence. I thought that would be a significantly longer time than 6 months labour.
Yeah.
Dear me. After completing his hard labour, John was once again back on the streets and resumed his habit of drifting for the next few years. In 1924, John was arrested for a fourth time. Again, they keep getting more elaborate. After attempting to steal a car from a Roman Catholic priest that he had befriended, he received a 3-month sentence for his crime and was sent straight back to Wandsworth Prison. I think, again, these crimes, they're all ranging crimes, but they are escalating in seriousness. And I don't think they've ever kind of looked at all of the different things he's done and gone, you know what, let's give him a couple of years here.
I guess, like we've covered on cases, you know, within memory, the communication between police forces and the kind of history of the offences people have isn't, especially back then, they wouldn't have a good system where they'll pass on knowledge, would they? So you essentially move around the country and you are going there with a clean slate. Yeah, so you steal from a priest there, hit a sex worker in the head of a cricket bat in another city, just move about, pop and weave. But yeah, it's...
I think what probably helped him as well is his exterior, how he came across, his shell, because you look at him and you just think, he couldn't do that. He wouldn't do that, but... He was.
And because, yeah, like you mentioned earlier, it's quite softly spoken after the mustard gas attack as well, which, you know, adds to that kind of like pathetic temperament, which people thought was, yeah, like you said, wouldn't be one to do these kind of things. So whilst imprisoned at Wandsworth, John began writing letters to Ethel after having somehow obtained information regarding her whereabouts. And to the surprise of many, Ethel began writing back to him. And eventually she began even travelling from Yorkshire to London in order to visit him in prison. During one of these visits, John begged Ethel to get back together with him and move down to the capital with him. And unbelievably, she accepted. John was released in February of 1934 and the pair were officially reunited. They began living in shared accommodation across different parts of London for the next 3 years, during which time John once again began visiting sex workers. So it's like, you've been given a second chance with this woman that you've been... trying to win back for however long, and then you go, back to cheatings, before they eventually settled on a particular property located in Notting Hill, London, number 10 Rillington Place. Yes, so this is obviously the infamous place where John would commit some heinous acts. So Notting Hill at the time was considered one of the most run-down, neglected, and impoverished parts of London, with crime running rife and many of the streets filled with rubbish, rats, and rubble. All the R's.
All the R's, yeah. Mm. Terrifying. The three R's. There are probably worse R's, to be fair.
Pain in the R's. The pair initially moved into the third story of number 10, before eventually moving into the ground floor apartment. The house itself, it was in a semi-derelict condition, with crumbling stone doorways and deafening noise echoing from nearby train tracks. That does sound very stressful. Crumbly stone doorways. Yeah, the trains would get on my nerves. It was certainly not a pleasant area or property to live in, but John and Ethel grabbed the opportunity of a new life together with both hands. The three-story end of Terrace House was built during the 1870s in a rush to create lots of new buildings quickly in London, and by the time it eventually became number 10 Rillington Place, it was just like many others in the area, old, poorly taken care of, and split into different apartments in order to generate the most income. Very much like London now. Just a bit satire.
But Notting Hill is quite swanky now, isn't it?
I've heard. Is. Yeah. It's gentrified, I imagine, from a long time ago. But I guess that's the way of the world now. Sad. Yeah, like all the arty people move to a certain area. People are like, that's nice, Randy. Let's build a few coffee shops. Oh, we'll get some flats there. And suddenly, people can't afford to live anymore. They move somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's a fucking shame, Ben. It's a fucking shame. Each apartment had a bedroom and a living room on the first two floors, plus a kitchen. But on the top floor, there are only two rooms, a kitchen combined with a living area and a bedroom. Living there was tough, with conditions described as squalid. Squalid. Squalid?
Squalid.
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 Yeah,
this place is a bit squalid.
Mm.
Why did we move here, Ethel? It's very squalid.
Give it time, John.
That's not Ethel. Why are you in my house? Squalid. And everyone had to share one outdoor toilet. I'm sure everyone that's been to a festival would know. That is pretty grim, especially on a frosty night. No, thank
you. Well, we learned last week that you couldn't poo on another man's poo. Something to take away from the Stamford Prison episode. Because I don't think there was proper plumbing. Well, there was plumbing, but not proper plumbing.
I think the phrase was, I didn't like to poo on another man's poo.
Oh, not
or just another person to poo on. Yeah. I'm not going to discriminate. But you were really into it.
Watch the episode.
I don't think we're going to watch just for that. Ben was right! So there wasn't any bathroom in any of the apartments, which, yeah, I think around the time, I'm not sure how...
I think that was pretty common, but it was still rough.
So you had to walk through part of the ground floor apartment in order to access the garden. Yeah, not an ideal living situation, but in theory, you know, back with the love of his life, and, you know, the only way is up, but sadly, not to be the way.
When he was first released from prison, John took up work as a cinema foreman in Hammersmith. However, with the outbreak of another world war once again on the horizon, it handed John another opportunity. So yeah, as terrible as both wars were, for John they were great because at both points he's trying to reinvent himself and looking for opportunity, and they've both landed on his doorstep. So with the outbreak of World War II, John was deemed not to be medically fit to serve in the British Army, and so he applied to be a War Reserve Police Constable. And shockingly, perhaps due to the need of the position being filled quickly, or perhaps due to Christie's outward appearance and demeanour, those hiring for the position did not perform a criminal background check on him, and therefore offered him the job. So yeah, I think it was kind of a combination of both. They were really impressed by him. They didn't check, obviously, the records. They needed people in positions quickly. And yeah, he was offered the job fairly quickly. Dressed in his latest uniform of disguise, John took to the streets of London and began patrolling his rounds. And whilst many other men were away fighting for their country, John made plans to take full advantage of his new situation and anybody that dared to enter his life. It is here that we move to the timeline of John Reginald Christie, the monster of Rillington Place.
So just to note, we're going to be referring to John Reggie Christie as Christie in the timeline. So just in case it's thrown anyone, that's what we're going to do. In the early 1940s, Christie is working as a special police constable whilst World War II rages on. The main duties of this role were to patrol the streets in the Harrow Road district and to predominantly deal with petty crimes. These were crimes, of course, that he was more than familiar with. Christie seems to have shaken off his previous criminal behaviour and is relishing the opportunity to be somewhat of an authority figure, but he is still mocked by his colleagues. He cannot escape any kind of judgmental or little jibes at him.
This is particularly biting, though, this bit.
Many of whom would make fun of his small stature and large forehead. He's also teased for his Yorkshire accent and the fact he was going bald. One colleague noted the following.
I worked with him on all kinds of crime investigations. He was always secluded and reticent and never mixed with the boys. But he knew his job. In his time, he had brought to justice hundreds of thieves, blackmailers, fraudsmen, and men who were found guilty of sexual assaults on women.
If I was someone who took that path, I wouldn't mind being called a fraudsman. It's quite seems quite like, makes me think of a guy on a sword, even though it's just because of the rhyme. But it's quite a nice word. Despite this, Christie strikes up a friendly relationship with Gladys Jones, a lady that worked at his local police station. The co-workers eventually entered an affair whilst her husband, a British Army soldier, was away fighting in the war. So yeah, very... This affair would continue for the next 3 years and is one that would come back to haunt both of them in the future.
Just to go back to this quote that Dan just did about the co-worker saying, yeah, I worked with him, he kept to himself, didn't, you know, go for beers with the boys, but he arrested hundreds of people. I'm assuming that can't be Christie elaborating his arrest. I'm sure there must be, that must have been recorded.
Yeah, the accounts of him was he was actually really good at that job. I can imagine him being a right little, like, Randall from Recess. Like,
yeah.
Any little thing, he's like...
Yeah, minor infraction. Yeah. But he'll know what to look for, though, as a petty criminal himself. Well, not even petty. He's done some terrible things by this point.
You're loitering. Come here. Yeah, I think he'd be very on the money in terms of that. So Christie would become well known by his neighbours as someone that was reliable and would always keep you informed of criminal activity in the area. He would regularly stop by his neighbours' homes to have cups of tea with them, where he would tell stories for hours about his time in the war and his alleged history as a medical professional. Many of whom were women, living alone without husbands who were at war. He was viewed as harmless but helpful, and everybody referred to him as Reg. He became sociopathic in that he literally believed and was living in and amongst all of his lies he was telling. He almost felt as he was now completely invincible and beyond any form of punishment.
Having a cup of tea seems as much a part of my murder career as whiskey is with other murderers.
Sounds a very odd thing to say.
Very jarring. 24th of August, 1943. This date marks the first confirmed murder at the hands of the monster of Rillington Place. Though some people believe that there may have been many other murders prior to this date that simply remained unreported. Christie's MO quickly became targeting people that, quote, if they were to go missing, they would not be missed, which could possibly lend itself to there being additional victims across London at the time. So obviously, with the outbreak of World War II, the London bombings, there were a lot of people going missing at this time. It was a very chaotic time in London. So he would target people that were either widows or immigrants or people without family in London that would not, you know, report or notice if their relative went missing. Yeah, which is horrifically clever from Christie's side. Christie's first known victim was 21-year-old Ruth First, an Austrian woman who had immigrated to London and occasionally worked as a sex worker in order to pay her rent. According to Christie, he met Ruth late at night outside a snack bar in Ladbroke Grove while she was looking for clients.
We have said like how Christie's reputation was quite good within the police force and he got many arrests. The one thing he did like to do was abuse his power and essentially blackmail sex workers and say, you know, I'm not going to bust you for this work, but obviously I scratch your back, you have sex with me. He would abuse his power as a policeman in order to get essentially free sex from sex workers.
So obviously on this particular night, he spotted Ruth outside of the snack bar. They chatted for a while before he invited her to his home for sex whilst his wife was away in Yorkshire visiting relatives. After their encounter, Christie disappeared into the adjoining room before suddenly emerging and strangling Ruth with a rope on his bed. He then hid her body under the floorboards of his living room before burying her in his back garden during the early hours of the next day. Many believe that Christie had spiked Ruth's drink prior to his attack. And that's a thing to note. Obviously, Christie is not a very big guy whatsoever. He's very kind of small and unimposing. A big part of his MO would later involve the use of gas and other kind of chemical agents to render his victims unconscious while he then performed his attacks.
I remember, as I gazed down upon the still form of my first victim, experiencing a strange and peaceful thrill. All my life, I have never experienced fear or horror at the sight of a corpse. On the contrary, I have seen many and they hold an interest and deep fascination over me.
I remember as I gazed down upon the still form of my first victim. Yeah, I don't know what Dan interrupted our case with telling us that a bit about himself, but there you go.
Very good. No, yeah,
that was Christie. December 1943, Gladys Jones's husband abruptly returns from the war to find John Christie in a house with her. Yeah, I think he actually finds them in bed together, which is very cliche, isn't it? Infuriated, the man beats Christie within an inch of his life. Christie takes a few days away from the work in hope that rumours of the affair do not reach colleagues or his wife's attention. He informs his wife that he was assaulted by a gang of robbers and says the same to his colleagues when he returns to work. And everybody believes his lie, which by this point, you know, he's a fine hand at spinning that yarn. Several months after this, perhaps as a result of the affair or a result of his first murder, Christie resigns from his position as special constable and takes up work as a clerk at a local radio factory. Park Royal Radios.
You've got to be an advert, hasn't it?
Go on, Tom, I'll do your jingle.
Park Royal Radios, why not stop by and get to... Park Royal Radios, why not stop by and tune in to some great, great deals? And if you're a sex worker, just fuck me and I'll give it to you for free.
Fucking hell.
Good bloody Christie, you're an eye for advertising. He quickly befriends a new colleague and begins to wait for his opportunity to bring her back to number 10, Riddington Place.
I think as well, that special constable role, arguably his most senior level position in all of his life, he's not been sacked from it. He's resigned.
Better to retire and goes, lads, you know, it's been a good run, but the radios need me now.
Yeah. Wow. And I bet as well when he was telling them about this gang of robbers that it was a massive gang, big, big gang. There was at least 12 of them. October 7th, 1944. 14 months after murdering Ruth First, Christie finally finds the opportunity to invite 31-year-old Muriel Amelia Eady back to his home. And this is the work colleague at the radio that Tom mentioned. Once again, Christie's wife Ethel is away in Yorkshire visiting relatives, and so the monster decides to strike.
Hunger, locked up till lunch.
Fucking hell. So a note to make on Muriel. Muriel had lived a troubled life. She was orphaned at an early age after her mother suddenly passed away in 1918. Her father, as a result of this, placed her and her siblings into various foster homes and care systems as he was unable to cope with the children by himself. In some of these locations, it is alleged that Muriel was abused. Muriel had been working at Park Royal Radios for many years before she met Christie, who quickly noticed that she had a fairly consistent cough. After a few months of Christie potentially filling her head with stories of his war heroics and self-professed medical background, Muriel eventually agreed to go back with him to number 10 Riddington Place after work in order to take what he had described as a special mixture that he had prepared in hopes that it would cure, well, not in hopes actually, he promised that it would cure her bronchitis.
So it reminds me of a thing we didn't actually mention in last week's case, which Margaret from the Bain family, she used to administer herself if she had a cough. Phlegm and piss.
Oh, how do we miss that?
Yeah, she used to drink that.
Why?
Her own?
Yeah, her own, yeah. Yeah, it's not weird. It has to be her own. But yeah, phlegm and piss.
What a cocktail.
Yeah. Oh. Well, yeah, I mean, on this as well, because Christie's bringing people back when his wife, specifically when his wife is away visiting family in Yorkshire, but what he would also be aware of is other tenants in 10 Riddington Place. So he would try his best to bring them into the ground floor without anyone seeing. But if anyone ever did see him with other women, he would simply say that they were coming back to the flat strictly for medicinal purposes. Once Christie got her back to the house, Muriel was tricked into breathing from a jar with a tube placed into it. The jar contained Friar's Balsam, which Christie used to cover up the smell of gas. And yeah, did a little look. Apparently Friar's Balsam has a very strong vanilla scent to it. So yeah, this would kind of disguise the smell of gas that she would eventually inhale. Whilst Muriel breathed from the tube with her back turned, Christie secretly connected another tube to the jar, which was linked to a gas tap. As Muriel kept breathing, she unknowingly inhaled the gas directly from the tap, which made her pass out. After rendering Muriel unconscious, Christie raped and strangled her with her own tights, and he then waited until the dusk hours before burying her in the back garden alongside Ruth. So on recalling the murder of Muriel, Christie would say the following.
For me, a corpse has a beauty and dignity which a living body could never hold. There is a piece about death that soothes me.
April of 1948, we fast forward 4 years here. Not a great deal of information is known about this period in terms of Christie's life and what he got up to, and it is possible that he could have claimed more victims during this time frame. What is known is that a young couple by the name of Timothy and Beryl Evans moved into the third floor flat of number 10 Riddington Place. Timothy and Beryl. Beryl's not really a name you hear much.
No. Nowadays. My nana had a friend called Beryl. She was lovely. I quite like that name.
Sounds like a barrel of laughs. The following year, on October 10th of 1949, the couple gave birth to a young daughter, whom they named Geraldine. Several months after this, despite their financial concerns around raising one child, the couple fell pregnant once again, which caused a huge fracture in their relationship. So this is a really key point in this case and Christie, and it's one that will actually go on to change quite a lot in British crime history, I'd say. It has a big ripple effect in terms of what would people would view certain punishments, etc., etc. We'll get into that. So for some background on Timothy and Beryl, as they play a huge part in this case, Timothy was born and raised in Wales, but had lived in London for most of his life, and by the time he moved to number 10 Rillington Place, apparently his accent would drastically shift between Welsh and Cockney, depending on who he was talking to. In whatever context you consume this case, most of the information about Timothy paints him as a fairly simple individual of below average intelligence. Like both of Christie's victims so far, Timothy came from a quite tumultuous family dynamic. His father abandoned the family before he was born, and he always blamed himself for it. As well as this, Timothy was involved in an accident when he was 8 years old that resulted in a lifelong injury to his right foot. When he was recovering from the injury, he developed a tuberculous verruca on the base of his foot that never fully healed.
Yeah, the pictures look nasty.
Oh, it's one of those where you search it and it's immediately got like, do you want to see this popping up? Oh. This caused him to miss a significant amount of time from school, setting him back greatly in his education, as well as cross country. As a result, by the time he was an adult, Timothy struggled to read and write on his own at any great length. He struggled to read comics, receipts, or even his wage slips. And just like Christie, he was prone to making up stories about himself in order to boost his self-esteem. His lies, unlike Christie's, would eventually land him in serious trouble. One note to make is that, unlike Christie, Timothy didn't have an extensive criminal background, apart from once stealing a car and driving without a license or insurance.
Timothy married Beryl in 1947, and the pair quickly began looking for a place of their own. The pair were described as a very loving but very volatile couple who often got into very loud, very public arguments. With both of them enjoying a drink, the pair also struggled to manage their finances properly, and on more than one occasion, Timothy spent his full week's wages at the pub, rather than saving it for money towards renting a property with Beryl. By the middle of 1949, the relationship between Timothy and Beryl almost completely deteriorated. The arguments between the pair were loud enough to be heard by the neighbours, and physical violence between them was witnessed on several occasions. They would regularly fight in front of their newborn daughter, Geraldine, and would also argue through all hours of the night, much to the annoyance of John Christie and his wife, Ethel. These arguments would often be followed up by sounds of the pair making up after each argument, which annoyed Christie even more. And one thing obviously I mentioned I watched some of the dramatisations. There's a very good BBC one with Tim Roth playing Christie. And in almost every scene that he's in, it's just Christie appearing from either behind a door or behind the stairs, or just he enters the scenes in the most awkward of fashions, but he's always there. And I get the sense that this was the case with Christie. He was always looking at what other tenants were up to, and always kind of, if there was an argument, he'd walk straight up the stairs and you know,
a lurker. Office.
Yeah, very much a lurker, and it comes across really
twitcher.
Well. Very much so, yeah. When Beryl told Timothy that she was pregnant for a second time, Timothy was initially over the moon, but Beryl was very keen to have an abortion due to the couple's lack of finances and Timothy's, quote, lack of ambition and stability.
That would hurt to hear.
Yeah.
We're skint, Tim, and you have no ambition, no stability.
And a bloody great old verruca. So they would, from this moment, obviously it's a huge moment for the couple, they would argue about this so much to the point that Christie eventually became fully aware of the situation and offered his medical services to the couple, taking advantage of and heavily manipulating Timothy in the process. He was basically implying that you could, you know, because abortion was illegal at the time in England, he said, I have a medical background, I've done this before many times. Your other option is a hot bath, a bottle of gin, and a sewing needle. Which is, horrifying. 8th of November 1949, after several weeks of offering his services to Timothy and Beryl, the couple finally agreed to allow John Reginald Christie to perform an abortion. As I mentioned, obviously abortion was illegal in England at the time, and Christie would try and use that against them, as well as their lack of finances and the possible dangers associated with the risk of going to what was deemed at the time Backstreet Doctors, terrible cover band, in order to convince them to go with him in the end. Christy informed Timothy to leave the house and go to work for several hours, whilst baby Geraldine stayed in the ground floor flat with Ethel. And yeah, this is the thing about Ethel. She's somewhat aware of what Christy is doing, so she's somewhat complicit, but I don't think she's completely aware of the extent and obviously the murderous elements to Christy. But she obviously took care of Geraldine, was aware of what he was doing upstairs with Beryl. Yeah, this is, as Tom said, a huge part in this particular case. After following his typical MO of giving Beryl a, quote, special gas to incapacitate her, Christy then raped Beryl before strangling her to death. When Timothy came back from work that night, Christy told him that Beryl had unfortunately died from septic poisoning during the procedure, and that they needed to hide her body because abortions were illegal and they could both be charged with murder. Despite being overwhelmed by shock and grief, Christy then persuaded Timothy to go and stay with his aunt and uncle in Wales and leave baby Geraldine with him, so that basically that gave Timothy a clear alibi for what had happened. So the pair together hide Beryl's body, and Timothy then flees to Wales. Timothy later claimed that he returned to the flat multiple times in order to check on baby Geraldine, but that Christy wouldn't let him see her on any attempt. So yeah, this is manipulation in the highest form from Christy here, and it's horrific and heartbreaking.
On November 30th, 1949, after eventually being caught out in numerous lies to his family and becoming overwhelmed with worry for his daughter, Timothy went to the police in Merthyr Tydfil and confessed that he accidentally killed Beryl by giving her something from a bottle a man had given him to help abort her baby, before he then disposed of her body in a sewer drain. As we said, he wasn't the cleverest of people, but yeah, I mean, you're saying you hide the body. Yeah, interesting that he went to the police himself. He said that he had made arrangements for Geraldine's care before going to Wales. At this point, he did everything he could not to implicate Christy, whom he viewed as an innocent man trying to help him and his family, which just goes to show the manipulation and the spell that he was under. After Timothy's confession, police immediately searched number 10 Renton Place, where they could not find anything out of place within the property. The investigators eventually found two corpses in an outdoor wash house at the bottom of the garden. One was Beryl, and one was 13-month-old Geraldine. They also found a 16-week male fetus.
Yeah, just grim.
Beryl's body was wrapped in a blanket and then a tablecloth. The postmortem showed that both she and her daughter had been strangled, and that Beryl had bruises on her face from being assaulted. Timothy initially said Christy had killed his wife during an abortion gone wrong, but under police questioning, he confessed. However, there are many doubts about the truthfulness of his confession, as it seemed forced and very police-orientated. After being charged, Timothy retracted his confession and accused Christy again, this time of both murders. Ultimately, despite pleas from Timothy and his family, with Christy as the key witness in the trial for both the prosecution and the defence, disturbingly, after less than 2 hours of deliberations, the jury found Timothy guilty despite the revelation of Christy's criminal record of theft and violence. Timothy was sentenced to death by hanging. When the verdict was read, Christy broke down in tears in front of the court. Despite launching numerous appeals and remaining adamant of his innocence until his very last breath, Timothy Evans was executed by hanging on March 9th, 1950. His executioner was Albert Pierpont.
So yeah, well, I mean, we've kind of condensed that a little bit in terms of the Timothy Evans case here. One thing that stood out as his written confession seeming very forced, obviously he couldn't read or write to a high degree, and the statement was written in, as Tom said, very police manner. So it had name, date, time, location, occupation. It was all the key details they needed to find him guilty and implicate him were within the first paragraph or two.
Yeah, the language used was very not his kind of language as well. So some people speculated whether or not it's just he was saying it to a policeman and the policeman wrote it in his own words. Very dubious, to say the least.
14th of December 1952, during the early hours of the morning, either due to an argument or entirely out of the blue, John Christy makes the decision to strangle his wife Ethel to death while she lay in her bed. This is made further complicated by the fact that Ethel had not been seen in public for 2 days prior to her murder. After he strangled her, having run out of room in the garden and knowing that the outhouse was likely to be investigated, he removed several floorboards from the kitchen and placed her dead body beneath them.
When I murdered my wife, I removed the one obstacle which, for 10 years, had apparently held me in check. After she had gone, the way was clear for me to fulfill my destiny. For years, I knew I just had to kill 10 women, then my work would be finished.
Christy made up different stories to explain his wife's disappearance and avoid further questions. He told relatives in Sheffield that Ethel could not write to them because of her rheumatism, and he told one neighbour that she was away visiting family in Sheffield. He also told another neighbour that she went to Birmingham. So again, yeah, his stories are getting very convoluted and he's telling different people different things.
It's a web.
It's a John Christie web, and a lot of people have unfortunately got tangled into it. As Christie had quit his job the week prior, in order for him to get by, he ended up selling Ethel's wedding ring and also her watch for £2.10, as well as some furniture from the flat. He survived predominantly on weekly unemployment benefits. The following year, Christie forged Ethel's signature and emptied her bank account, and he also sold or gave away the majority of her clothing. And in doing this, he would ultimately look for sympathy and to garner some form of attention by telling his female friends that they could have her clothing because his wife had abandoned him. On the 19th of January 1953, following his typical MO, Christie lures 25-year-old Rita Nelson back to 10 Rillington Place after she allegedly, though many people do dispute this, demanded money from him in the street. Rita was originally from Belfast and was 6 months pregnant at the time. She was visiting her sister in London when she came across Christie. He took her back to the house where he gave her a cup of tea, potentially laced with drugs, before strangling her to death and placing her at the back of his kitchen alcove. So alcove, do we need to explain what an alcove is? Because it's the first time I've heard one in one of the cases we've covered.
It's just a little bit of room in it.
Yeah.
A little extra bit.
It says a recess in the wall of a room or garden. The rest of the tables were in the little alcoves around the bar, is the example given.
A little extra bit of a room.
Yeah.
26th of February 1953. The following month, once again following his typical MO, Christie lures 26-year-old Kathleen Maloney back to his home, which at the time had two bodies buried in its garden, had one body in its kitchen alcove, and had the body of his wife beneath the floorboards for over 2 months. Kathleen was working as a sex worker. Christie offers her a drink before gassing her and strangling her to death. He then places her dead body on top of Rita's in the kitchen alcove. On the 6th of March 1953, just over a week later, after having regularly met up at a local cafe with 26-year-old Hectorina McLennan and her boyfriend Alex, I think Alex Baker was the name.
Hectorina McLennan
and Alex Baker. He had been seeing this car. He was familiar with them. He was on good terms with them. They'd been regularly sharing cups of tea and coffee at a local cafe. He was aware they were looking for accommodation. He'd also briefly allowed them to stay in Rillington Place whilst they were continuing to search for a more permanent residence. He basically, after many weeks of trying, manages to get Hectorina to the house by herself with the promise of giving her some of his wife's dresses. Christie then, when she's looking at the dresses in the wardrobe, attacks her before strangling her to death and placing her in what was the remaining space of the kitchen alcove. In the weeks that followed, he regularly met up with her boyfriend Alex in order to help him try and find Hectorina, and he also allowed Alex to come over to Rillington Place to look for himself and also have cups of tea with him. So this is horrific. This is all of it's absolutely horrific, but he's now pretending, and I suppose Alex is believing, I'm a former police officer, soldier, field medic, I'm going to help you find her, when all along he knows that he's killed her.
Lots of tea,
yeah, the tea, cups of tea with Reg, sit down and I'll put the kettle on. Just don't like it. Christie would recall the following about murdering Hectorina.
I seized hold of her by the neck and applied just sufficient pressure to make her limp. I took her to the back of the kitchen and decided that it was essential to use the gas again. I made love to her, and then I put her back in the chair. I killed her.
All three victims, Rita, Kathleen and Hectorina, had been murdered via a combination of strangulation and carbon monoxide exposure before being placed into the kitchen alcove together. He would repeatedly visit each of their corpses in order to perform acts of necrophilia on them. To disguise the bodies, the entrance to the alcove was then eventually wallpapered over. But yeah, he didn't do like a structural fix over the alcove. He just put a couple of bits of MDF and wallpaper. So it was a bit of a botched job to hide the bodies.
I guess he couldn't get professionals in. It'd be a bit of a...
Yes, that's true.
So on the 20th of March 1953, Christie had basically hoodwinked some people in getting... He was subletting his property, essentially, or giving some money so they could move into the property, not telling the landlord. And then he basically makes a runner with the money and screwing those people over. So he leaves the property of 10 Rillington Place and started living in different rented accommodations around London. The tenant on the top floor flat, Beresford Brown, had begun to use Christie's kitchen in his absence when he noticed a foul smell emanating from the room. Brown put it down to external issues and continued cooking. He then went to install a bracket on the kitchen wall in order to hang his portable radio, when his nail went straight through, revealing the secret kitchen alcove. Imagine the smell that would have came from that hole as well. He was met by a ghastly sight of three dead bodies piled on top of one another and immediately called for the police. An extensive search of 10 Rillington Place is launched, uncovering the decomposed body of Ethel Christie beneath the floorboards and two additional skeletons in the back garden. A nationwide search for John Reginald Christie is launched. All sorts of sensational newspaper headlines are published, together with Christie's image. Exactly 1 week later, after having spent the majority of his time sleeping rough, Christie is spotted by PC Thomas Ledger, staring vacantly at the river over Putney Bridge.
Little shout out to Ben Bonsey, who edits our YouTube videos. He used to live near there, in Putney. But I think that's where the connection to John Christie stops for Bonsey.
He's immediately taken into custody, and upon searching him, they find a cutting of an article about the arrest of Timothy Evans in his coat pocket, which is a very peculiar trophy to be carrying around, and it's one that's very, like, shows how callous he was about the whole case for that one. Obviously, he had other trophies in the house with the bodies remaining there, him revisiting the bodies, but yeah, that one in particular really kind of sticks to mind about his morals and also how Timothy took advantage of Timothy and essentially, yeah, was happy to kind of see him go down. Over the course of the next 2 months, Christie is interviewed numerous times and also put to trial. He immediately admits to the murder of his ex-wife, as well as the three women in his kitchen alcove. When it is revealed to Christie that two skeletons were found in his garden, he admits to being responsible for the murders too. And then, finally, Christie admits to murdering Beryl Evans, the murder of which Timmy Evans was hanged for. A huge amount of pressure is placed on Christie to admit the murder of 13-month-old Geraldine Evans, but he continues to deny it, possibly through fear of repercussions from other inmates or to avoid angering the jury into not potentially finding him not guilty by reason of insanity. So Christie would go on to plead insanity, with his defence counsel declaring him as mad as a March hare to the courts, which is quite the expression. He's mad as a box of frogs, this one. Thankfully, the jury rejected his pleas. After deliberating for an hour and a half, they found him guilty. He was sentenced to death by hanging, just as Timothy Evans had been 4 years prior. At 9 a.m. on 15th of July 1953, John Reginald Christie was hanged at HM Prison Pentonville by Albert Pierpoint, the same man and location as Timothy Evans. Apparently, when Christie was walked to the gallows and had a hood placed over his head, he complained that his nose had started to itch. Yeah, he got more things to worry about, Christie. Albert Pierpoint quickly remarked, "It won't bother you for long," before pulling the trap-lit door lever. Christie's body was buried in an unmarked grave within the prison precinct. Despite decades of arguments and some people still trying to point him as the guilty party, Timothy Evans was posthumously pardoned in 1966. Christie was executed having murdered at least 8 people, but a morbid collection of his 4 different victims' pubic hair that he kept in his possession only matched to one of his victims, his wife Ethel. So obviously that leads on to believe that there's 3 other victims there that aren't from that crime scene, so people speculate he had actually killed more people. No attempts were or have since been made to trace any further victims of Christie, despite hundreds of women going missing in London during World War II and the John Christie decade of horror. A thing to note on the Timothy Evans case, people believe that that's kind of one of the key cases that reasons we don't have capital punishment in the UK. On the case of him being wrongly convicted, I think, it's such a sad one. I mean, obviously, this whole case is terribly sad, and people having trust in someone who they deemed as being, you know, pathetic essentially, and someone who's harmless, he's taken advantage of a lot of people, and essentially Timothy's naiveness and kindness has essentially got himself killed.
Yeah, I think in a lot of different books and documentaries, he's considered Christie's 9th victim.
Timothy, obviously, B was complicit in terms of hiding Beryl's body, but Beryl, of course, she wanted to have the abortion as well, so both Timothy and Beryl went into that with the same intention. It was Timothy's kind of thinking that, you know, it was an innocent mistake from Christie, that he then tried to defend him behind the body of Beryl, and then he kind of got himself into a bit of a mess he couldn't get himself out of. So in essence, you know, he got capital punishment due to the fact he was trying to be kind to Christie, and obviously he had no idea what would happen to Geraldine. But yeah, it's a very sad case.
Definitely. So yeah, so that was the case of John Reginald Christie, the monster of Riddington Place. Little bit of aftermath for you. So American brutal death metal band Deeds of Flesh have a little track that they like to call Spewing Profligacy. And that includes the John Reginald Christie quote that Dan read at the start of the episode. And it goes a little bit like this.
That could literally be someone who don't say anything.
Like, yeah, I mean, I searched lyrics as well to double check it. But yeah, and from my limited exposure to death metal, I thought that sounded quite a bit like Mayhem. Other notable tracks include Ideal Genocide, Human Trophies, 3 Minute Crawl Space, Master of Murder, Drink the Blood, Hunting Humans, Chunks in the Shower, and personal favourite, An Eternity of Feasting and Brawling, which I think might be a love song.
I'm sure Chunks in the Shower isn't about YouTuber chunks. It's from something else. But yes, that's very... Yeah.
On the matter of things that are a bit spooky, Australian artist Brett Whiteley, who lived in central London during the 1960s, released a series of paintings after she learned of the Rillington Place murders. And there are a few that have been done of Christie himself, and to look at them in the context of this case, well, even just to look at them without the context of this case, they are pretty terrifying. So we'll pop some pictures up for you now. In 1971, the movie 10 Rillington Place was released, and it stars Richard Attenborough, brother of David, playing Christie. And it's got, held in very high regard. It's got some pretty good reviews, 7.5 out of 10 on IMDb, although it's only 64% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. On playing Christie, Richard made the following remarks.
I did not like playing the part, but I accepted it once without seeing the script. I've never felt so totally involved in any part as I did with this. It is the most devastating statement on capital punishment.
Hangman Albert Pierrepoint worked on the film as a technical advisor, and only Richard Attenborough was allowed in the original 10 Rillington Place property for the filming of one particular scene, which is of him looking out the window at the arriving police.
This is 10 Rillington Place. Dee, dee,
dee, dee. Welcome.
That's the way, not this is. Welcome to 10 Rillington Place.
In 2016, a 3-part miniseries was released by the BBC. This is the one I watched the other week. And yeah, Tim Roth is very, very good in it. And it's also, it's got much more fresh on Rotten Tomatoes rating. He's always appearing, Tim Roth, just out of windows and door frames and stuff. Yeah, always appearing. First thing I noticed was the nicknames of this case. But then the other thing I did was trying to find 10 Rillington Place on my Google Maps, because I thought, oh, London's not that far. We can go and have a little look. But it doesn't exist. The entire street has been rebuilt and renamed. Shortly after Christie's arrest in 1953, the street was renamed Runton Close, possibly in a bid to scrub off the recent history of the street. The house was then fully demolished in 1978, so it stood there for quite a period of time, especially if you compare it to last week's episode, where it was then subsequently renamed Bartle Close, and a decade later they were knocked down once again to become a series of modernised flats on a street that was renamed St Andrew's Square. And yeah, it looks a vastly different place now, and that's what it remains as to date, just around the corner from Portobello Market for the market lovers, and just around the corner from Notting Hill Bookshop for the Hugh Grant and Julia Roberts lovers.
You do quite often fall into creepy local tour guide for
I
a
do.
Lot of the cases, yeah.
I
really
find
nice
it, yeah.
place if you like, for the market lovers, and one for the Notting Hill fans.
But yeah, very different looking place, very modernised. Perhaps unsurprisingly, people have not been put off moving there. A man named Kjell Ole Horn, sorry if I've, it's Norwegian. Kjell Ole Horn. I'm going to go with Kjell. A Norwegian man named, and I'm sorry if I butcher.
No day.
A Norwegian man named, and apologies if I butcher this, Kjell Ole Horn, 48-year-old semi-famous composer, purchased the property behind the original 10 Rillington Place, which has a small communal garden that basically is the spot where the actual house existed. So that's a remembrance garden that hasn't been touched. And he claims that he decided it's no worse than living anywhere else in London. He made the following remark to The Independent.
Unless you can show me one plot of land where someone hasn't been killed, slaughtered, raped, or stabbed in the past 1,000 years, well, I don't think that plot of land in London exists.
So we've had one for the market fans, we've had one for the bookshop fans, now one for the football fans. Both John Christie and Timothy Evans were big fans of Queen's Park Rangers.
QPR, baby!
QPR, there he goes, he's got it. And then also, a quick shout out. We have got a Facebook group, which is bustling at the moment. And each week we include different things from the research and the cases. Big shout out to the 1990 weekly murder casebook magazines that my parents used to collect. I found information in here that I could not find anywhere else. It's got loads of extra stuff and photos I've not seen before. It's got a little map of the house.
No.
So what I'll do is I'll scan it and pop it into the Facebook group for people. I think you can get them each. It's book number 4 if you want to buy the individual one, and I'm pretty sure you can get them on eBay.
How many pages are there, Ben?
Tell you what, this one's hefty.
Scanner Montana.
Yeah, there's at least 30 pages in here.
Ooh,
yeah,
hefty.
Handwriting analysis,
floorboards.
Yeah, Christie as a baby, which I thought looked a bit like Baby Gervais.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah,
Scout. There you go. Yeah. So yeah, why not join the Facebook group and have a look at that? And also, yeah, just join in the chats in there. And also, why not head over to ickmap.co.uk and join the website, join the cult. We have 3 different tiers over there for different prices. One, a taster tier, we can kind of dip your toe in, and the other 2, where you get a few more perks. You also get early access to the cases, as well as access to our Discord, and nearly 150 minisodes on there now. So why not head over there and get involved?
And I mentioned, obviously, this week's cryptic clue for Reg, you know, the strange number plate, might have annoyed some people. This one, I promise, if anyone gets it, I will, you have a meal voucher, a dinner voucher that you can go and take someone out for a meal, or I'll go for the meal with you, £100. So let me know if anybody gets this. I'll be livid if someone does get this.
And don't message me for a clue.
Yeah.
Because I'm not going to, I'd hate for Ben to spend £100 that he didn't need to spend. So,
yeah.
Benjamin Carter's cryptic clues. Everyone gather around for some clues that can be quite cryptic, but he's going to give them to you anyway. Hope you can figure them out.
Okay. So the clue for next week's episode, the cryptic clue for next week's episode is that Yorkshire Guard is looking all over the place. That Yorkshire Guard is looking all over the place. Quite apt as well, because Reggie was from Yorkshire and also a guard briefly. And he wore glasses. But it's not, we're not doing Reg again.
Just to clarify, that is a fucking appalling cryptic clue.
That's great. Dan liked it.
But yeah, thing is like, if you were to contact me or Dan and offer us, let's say, £20, you'd be £80 up going for a meal. So, yeah.
Oh, don't cheat.
No, don't cheat, of course. And obviously, we're not going to do that to Ben. But
yeah, don't do it.
No, don't.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back again, of course, next week with a new case, which you'll never figure out from Ben's clue. But until then, like we always say...
We say this all of the time.
Keep on doing what you're doing.
Well, unless it's what this guy got up to.
False start, Carter.
Well, Sharks a limp Lambert. Sorry, Dan, you got caught in the crossfire there.
I asked for it.
Oh. Unless it's Daniel stealing people's post money, playing with their packages.
Playing with the packages. Yeah, on that note. See you later. See you a bit.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I Could Murder a Podcast is proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. For hundreds of extra minisodes and other content, along with our private Discord server and live Q&As, exclusive merch and much more, consider subscribing to icmap.co.uk.